Be there or else.
This is 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. We had hoped to talk with Sister Helen Prejean today, but her schedule did not allow that to happen. Instead, Craig LeBeau will be speaking with Nebraska State Senator Colby Koash, who was instrumental in passing the bill that abolished the death penalty in Nebraska, as well as the vote to override the governor's veto. In the second half of today's show, Margo Patterson will speak with Mark Schindler, Executive Director of the Justice Policy Institute, about the emerging political consensus in favor of criminal justice reform and what reforms he hopes will come out of it. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Craig and his guests are up next.
Okay, this is Craig LeBeau, and thank you for joining us in Jaws of Justice. The Nebraska legislature this past May voted 30-19 to override a veto of Governor Rob Ricketts. The bill that had passed that he had vetoed was to repeal the death penalty in Nebraska. We have with us today Senator Colby Koash, who is a member of the Nebraska legislature. He was first elected in 2008 and won re-election in 2012. He serves on several committees, including as vice chair of the Judicial Committee. He played a critical role in the abolition of the death penalty in Nebraska. And welcome, Senator Koash. We'll get him back on the line. We did lose him. We do have, I have a few facts I'd point out about the death penalty. George Will, who is a conservative commentator, described capital punishment in America as withering away. He gave three reasons. One is the power for abolition. One is the power to inflict death cloaks government with a majesty and pretense of infallibility. Second, when inflicted, after somebody is executed, of course, it can never be corrected later. And third, he says that it has no deterrence effect. Some say that sentencing to death those who commit heinous crimes satisfies a sense of moral proportionality. However, this satisfaction is purchased, George Will says, is purchased with disproportionate social cost. We have organization called Conservatives Concerned About Death Penalty. Mark Hayden is the, I guess, the chair of that. He says the death penalty validates the core conservative principles of fiscal responsibility and limited government and valuing life. We also have an organization called Nebraskans for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. And that's headed by Matt Maley in Nebraska. And he says, quote, the success of the petition drive is an expression of a vocal minority. And what he's referring to is in Nebraska, the governor who had originally vetoed the legislation, he... one of the things he's done is to spearhead, along with this organization, a petition to get it on the ballot. And they got 166,000 signatures to get it on the ballot, which was almost double the number required. I believe it, I understand that it required 57,000. Do we have him back on the line? Welcome, Senator Koash.
Hello.
I already talked about a little bit of the legislative history of the bill. And what I'd like to get from you is, to start with, is why did you support repeal and what arguments did you use to to convince other conservatives in the state to support that?
I started to push this bill this year because what I did is I looked at what the death penalty was and how it lined up against conservative values, and really what we found, or I found and was able to convince my colleagues about, was that at least here in Nebraska, we hadn't used it in almost 20 years, and so it really became a poster child for inefficient, expensive, ineffective government. I said numerous times that if any other government program had been that costly and that inefficient, we would have gotten rid of it a long time ago. We also looked at a perspective of, is this too much power for government? We're supposed to be the check on a growing, too powerful government. And we really looked at the ability to do this as too much power for state government. So we put those things together, and it ended up being a conservative issue, and we changed the narrative from what it had been before.
All right. And, in fact, when you say too much power, before we got you back on the line, I quoted a quote from conservative commentator George Will, and that was one of the things he said: the power to inflict death cloaks government with the majesty.
Right. Well, the government's full of people. People are fallible, and we've had problems in our corrections system here in Nebraska and across the country. There have been problems, and the reality is sometimes government gets it wrong. And when you have a sentence like this, you can get it wrong. And trusting the government to get something like this right, when we know so many people have been erroneously executed, just seemed to be irrational. And so we abolished it. Now the other thing we talked about was, there was a guy who was on death row in Nebraska for over 30 years, and then he died of natural causes. And I got to speak to some of the victims' families of this guy, and his guilt was not in question. He did what he was accused of doing. But the victims in this case came to me and said, "Senator Kolash, how is it that when a crime is convicted or crime is committed against my loved one, and the state says the result of that crime, we're going to put that guy to death, and 30 years later it doesn't happen? How is that justice?" And we really had to face that reality that we had imposed sentences that we couldn't carry out, and we really weren't giving the justice that the state had promised. And so it became important for some of us to reverse that and just to say, well, we're going to have a sentence on the books that we can implement.
Okay. The governor in your state had vetoed this legislation, and then your legislature overrode it. Can you give us a little bit of insight as to why do you think the governor is so gung-ho in favor of capital punishment?
I don't want to speak for the governor. We see eye to eye on a lot of issues other than this one. As far as why he was so gung-ho, I think he believed strongly that this was a penalty that ought to remain on the books, and like I said, I don't want to speak for him, but he certainly has been adamant about his opposition to what we did.
Okay. There was two things that I know that he's done that I'm wondering how you feel about it. Is this something that you've ever heard of being done before or not? One of the things is that the organization that started the petition drive to get it before the voters, he actually, my understanding is, the governor donated $100,000 to that group.
Right. Well, it was actually $200,000, and then his father donated another $100,000. Here's what I'll say about that. That's the governor's money. I'm not going to tell people what they can and can't do with their own money. But it certainly is unusual to have that kind of a thing happen. I certainly wish that he would have disrespected the legislature's decision to override his veto and move on, but he's decided to continue to engage in this process through his own contributions to the reinstatement cause, and we'll see how that plays out.
He also attempted to purchase the drugs that were needed. I believe he was trying to get from a pharmacy in India. I think he was trying to do that even after the repeal, after you repealed the death penalty. And then it stopped. Well, two things. One is that my understanding from the FDA is that they warned him that what he was doing was illegal, trying to import that. And then Federal Express refused to ship it.
Right. That's my understanding as well. The governor made statements that he was attempting to purchase these drugs during the debate, after the debate, after the override, continues to try to acquire these drugs and hasn't had any success because the guy he's trying to get them from is not doing them, not doing business legally. So I don't anticipate he'll be successful, but I do anticipate he'll continue to try.
In Kansas and in several other states, there's an organization that the name of it escapes me, that is comprised of family members of victims who are against the death penalty. Are they active in your state too?
The man who sat on death row for 30 years, and I mentioned that victim's family, that family was part of that, repeal movement. But I have to say, in all fairness, there were people, victims' families on the other side, and they didn't want, they did want to see an execution take place, and certainly I've never been in that position, so I don't pretend to speak for families or I don't speak for them, but I can tell you one victim's family I talked to said that this was, every time we went through this and there was no finality to it, it was almost like re-victimizing her, and so it became important for me to say, victims' families on both sides deserve a sentence that can be carried out, no matter what that sentence is, which led me to push for the repeal.
In terms of the process that you went through, the legislation went through, what are some lessons that you would say that we can learn from in Kansas to get the legislature here to follow what you did?
Well, I think, I don't know how long your repeal effort has been going on. Our repeal effort had been going on for many decades before I became part of the legislature. What I can tell you is that it's got to be a bigger tent. Frankly, before myself and some other Republicans got engaged, this had always been viewed as a Democrat issue. It was always viewed as, it was always framed as an issue about equal justice, disparate impact of the death penalty. And we changed the narrative, and we brought in the tent to say, you can be against the death penalty, not in spite of being a conservative person, but because you're conservative. And it was that broadening of the tent, that idea that the repeal effort was aligned with conservative values, that really got us over the hump. And so, people in Nebraska came to their position for many different reasons, but we had to give them a lot of reasons so that one of them would stick. If that makes sense, we just really tried to make sure people understood there were a lot of good reasons, not just the traditional reasons to oppose the death penalty.
How do you respond for those who come back and say, well, they deserve it because they committed a heinous crime? What are some of your responses to that?
And I had people tell me that, and certainly our experience in Nebraska was there were people who were on death row or are on death row for doing some pretty heinous things. I mean, they were crimes that really, for a lot of reasons, had you know, gone beyond the pale, you know, and were pretty bad crimes. And I understood how victims felt, and I, you know, thankfully I've never been in that position, but I had to question myself, how would I feel if those crimes had been perpetrated against a member of my family? But what I can tell you is, and what I told them was, for every person who's sentenced to death for a crime like that, there's another person right in our own state who is sentenced to life in prison without parole or less for doing the same crime or a less heinous crime. It bared out in Nebraska, and I think it bears out in the rest of the country that it is not wielded justly. In other words, you could have one guy get the death sentence for a crime and another person get a very different sentence for a very similar crime. And so, you know, I think people, even though they want justice, they want it to be applied fairly, which is what justice is about. And so if you don't have a system that can be applied fairly, you should get rid of it. And that didn't help a lot everybody, but it certainly was an impactful argument that worked for many people.
For those who are just joining us, listeners just joining, we are talking to Senator Colby Koash from Nebraska, and the topic we're talking about is the death penalty. And Nebraska was a state that just this past summer in May repealed the death penalty. When you are talking to people, there's still a lot of people who are fixated on claiming that the death penalty is a deterrence, even though states like Texas that actually execute more people than any other state, it's obviously not a deterrent.
Well, that's the example I frequently give. If it were a deterrent, Texas would have very, very little crime. To say it's a deterrent gives the criminal mind a lot more credit than I think it deserves. Crimes that put you on death row, are crimes that very often are crimes of passion, and there is no forethought of, well, what state am I in? And will this, if I get caught for this crime, will I end up on death row? Even the most ardent supporters of the death penalty anymore don't use deterrence as an argument for the continuing of the practice. So I think that's pretty much, the ship has sailed on that idea. It certainly wasn't much of a factor in anybody's decision in Nebraska on either side.
And there's a couple organizations I'm aware of that are working to keep against the petition to keep the death penalty from coming back to Nebraska, and that's Nebraskans for Public Safety and Nebraskans for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. Are you working with those organizations some, and do you have concerns about what might happen? I know the organization that initiated the petition drive says that their claim is that they got twice the number of signatures required in just 12 weeks, and they think that there's a good chance it will be reinstated. And these other organizations are saying they're not worried, that it's just a very loud, vocal minority that they were able to appeal to get those signatures. What is your feeling on that?
Well, to answer your first question, I'm not formally working with either of those two groups. I'm sometimes asked to speak to their members about our experience, and so I stay connected, but they are they're not part of anything I'm personally involved in. I don't sit on their board. I don't campaign. I don't work for those organizations. The initiative that's going on in Nebraska did gather plenty of signatures, and I think that's a reflection of the fact that if you ask most people, and I understand this, hey, should we have a death penalty? I think most people would say, well, yeah, we should have a death penalty. If somebody does something terrible, you should have a way to return that. But at least in Nebraska, we haven't been able to use it. And so we're pretty practical people here in Nebraska, and what we say to them is, well, even if you like the death penalty, do you like inefficient government? I mean, we're pushing 20 years where we haven't been able to use it. Our governor has been unsuccessful in procuring the drugs and spent taxpayer money to try to do so, and we're wasting a lot of time and money on just 10 people, at least in our state. And so what these groups are doing is raising the level of discussion and getting information out, and that's not a bad thing. At the end of the day, the voters may have the opportunity to put this back on the books in November. Regardless if it happens, though, I can tell you that we've executed our last person in Nebraska because we're just unable to find a method to do it. And even Nebraskans who are for the death penalty are starting to come to the realization that even though they want it, that it's an impractical reality that we wouldn't be able to get it done. So we are moving down the track with more important things, at least in my mind, in Nebraska, so that we can do some different things and move on from this topic.
Yeah, I know we're going to have on Governor Ryan later in November, former Governor Ryan from Illinois. And one of the reasons they abolished in Illinois was because of what you mentioned at the top when we started, was all the wrongful convictions.
Right.
Is that a strong point in Nebraska in raising that?
I think it is, and we don't know in Nebraska if we've ever executed somebody who's truly innocent. But we do know that we've let people off of their sentences because of overturned convictions, and so you know, that's just a risk that most people were unwilling to take with regard to sentencing structure. That we didn't want to put an innocent person to death, and we know it's happened across the country, and that's something that you hope never happens, but you can never take it back if it does. And so we that was part of the argument here that got us where we are, but at the end of the day, like I said, there were a lot of reasons people voted to repeal this measure in Nebraska.
We are just about out of time. I do want to let people know, listeners, that excuse me, the Kansas Coalition Against the Death Penalty is having their conference, the 2015 Abolition Conference, on Saturday, November 7th at the First Baptist Church in Topeka, and that's located at 3033 Southwest McVicker Avenue in Topeka. And Senator Koash is going to be the keynote speaker at that conference. So I look forward to seeing you there, and thank you for joining us today.
Yep, glad to be on. Okay. Hope to see you soon.
This is the Jaws of Justice radio calendar for October 26, 2015. Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty and the Center for Global Studies and Social Justice at Avila University present Sister Helen Prejean, Friday, February 30th, 7 to 8:30 p.m., at Unity on the Plaza, 707 West 47th Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Sister Helen Prejean is an anti-death penalty activist and author of Dead Man Walking, the book that inspired the movie, and her new book, Deaths of Innocence. Tickets will be available at the door. For price, check out the MADP website at www.madpmo.org. And for more information, contact Stacy Pratt or go to stacy@madpmo.org. The Cross Borders Network for Justice and Solidarity will have their October membership meeting, October 26, 7:30 p.m. at the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation, 4801 Rock Hill Road, Kansas City, Missouri. They will be addressing where to go now that the KCMO City Council has repealed the minimum wage hike and other activities. The public is invited. For more information, check them out on Facebook or contact CBN Coordinator Melissa Styler at 816-308-2687 or Melissa at Cross Borders Network
www.keithbrownio.org. My name is Keith Brownio, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org.
You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. We want to thank our engineer today, Michael Murphy. We ask you to tune in next week to Jaws of Justice Radio when Beth Pike hosts a discussion on elder abuse with Michelle Brown at the Mid-America Regional Council, and Craig Lubow returns with former Governor Ryan of Illinois to talk about why he commuted all the death sentences in his state to life without parole. Up next is Margo and her guest, Mark Schindler.
This is Margo Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio. One of the most hopeful developments in our politics today is the emerging consensus among liberals and conservatives alike that our criminal justice system needs to be reformed. Suddenly, the injustice of our justice system, a topic that for years politicians avoided mentioning, has become something everyone is eager to talk about. President Obama and presidential candidates from both parties are speaking about the need for reform. Last week, more than 130 police chiefs, prosecutors, and sheriffs formed an organization called Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime and Incarceration to push for an end to mandatory minimum prison sentences and to advocate eliminating some petty offenses from the criminal code. Here to talk with us about the changing political climate as regards recognizing and rectifying the abuses in the criminal justice system is Mark Schindler, Executive Director of the Justice Policy Institute, a national nonprofit that advocates for making incarceration the recourse of last resort, not first recourse. Mr. Schindler, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here today.
Well, let's begin with talking about what has happened to so change our politics.
Well, I think it's a good question, and I think it's something that's been building for some time. For many, many years, there have been folks like me and others who have been talking about the fact that we are over-relying on incarceration and it's not getting us good outcomes. But in recent years, we've seen a broadening of that discussion, and where folks both on the conservative side of the spectrum and the more liberal side have started to come together to agree on this. And so I think this is potentially good news for our justice systems around the country.
Well, how did that coming together of conservatives and liberals come about? Did one side reach out to the other? Who are some of the key figures in this?
Sure. I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's definitely related to the fact that where we are in terms of the climate today, where crime rates are very low at all-time lows, and budget issues have come up in a number of states and at the federal level, where people are realizing that incarceration is costing us really extraordinary amounts and something that's not sustainable, and we're also not getting good outcomes. And so there have been folks both at the federal level, including senators on both sides of the aisle, who have come to this conclusion, and also in various states around the country, and some key conservative figures, people such as Newt Gingrich and others who have taken this on.
Well, why don't you give us a little background? Currently, there are about 2.2 million Americans incarcerated in our federal and state prisons and local and county jails. Since 1980, our prison population has quadrupled. If you could, talk a little about what led to the situation that exists today, where the U.S. incarcerates more people relative to its population than any other country in the world.
Sure. And as you noted, since the 80s, we've seen just an extraordinary increase in the number of people that we incarcerated. If you go back to the 60s and 70s, essentially the United States was similar to other industrialized nations, particularly in Europe, at the rate at which we incarcerated people. But since then, we've just gone off the charts. And there are a number of things that cause that. In some ways, first and foremost, is the drug war, which I think we many across the country now refer to as the failed war on drugs in this country. Combined with high crime rates and really an attack on illegal drugs in the country using a law enforcement approach, we saw things in the 80s and 90s, changes at the state and federal levels that resulted in very long sentences being implemented, things like three strikes, you're out, mandatory minimums, and incentives from the federal government for states to build more prisons and incarcerate people for longer periods of time. And that really got us to where we are now, where we by far incarcerate many more people than any other industrialized country in the world, really in history.
Nonviolent drug offenders have been the first beneficiaries of the recognition that mass incarceration is not the answer to every problem. What are some of the other reforms being considered?
Sure. Well, we're seeing this both at the federal and at the state level, where, again, there's a recognition of that the war on drugs is a failed effort. We incarcerate exponentially more people for drug use than we ever had before, but drug use continues to be the same. So we know that this is not an effective measure, and that many people now are talking about the fact that this is really a public health issue and we should take a public health approach. That's where the focus has been in many states in terms of nonviolent offenders, particularly drug offenders. But we also know that that's not the only folks who are locked up in our jails and prisons across the country. In fact, there are more people who are incarcerated, particularly at the state level, for violent offenses. And so if we're going to have an honest discussion about reducing these extraordinary levels of incarceration, we have to talk about both violent offenders and nonviolent offenders as well.
And what are some reforms that you would like to see adopted as far as, say, violent offenders?
Sure. And so particularly when we look at violent offenders, we know that we need to look not just at the offense, but at their risk level. And we're becoming much better in justice systems across the country at developing instruments, risk assessment instruments, that can identify what is the likelihood that someone would recidivate or commit another crime upon their release from prison. And it doesn't always track to those who are charged with the most violent offenses. So we need to, you know, look at the science on this and be guided by that in making decisions about who is released from prison and hopefully also have shorter sentences. We also know similarly that once people get by a certain age, essentially in their 20s and to some degree early 30s, they're much less likely to commit offenses. Because of the long sentences we have in place, we now have in our prisons around the country essentially a geriatric population, essentially senior citizens who are being incarcerated far longer than public safety would require.
The Black Lives Matter movement has drawn attention to the problem of police brutality, especially as regards people of color. How much, if at all, do you think that movement is influencing the conversation we're now seeing around the criminal justice system?
Well, I think it is influencing the conversation quite a bit, and rightly so. As we know, over the past year, and I don't have to tell anybody in Missouri, you know, how this conversation has evolved following the deaths of Michael Brown, Eric Garner in New York, and others around the country, Freddie Gray in Baltimore. It really has sparked a conversation that's needed to happen for some time, looking at how police are interacting with people in the community, particularly in communities of color and particularly poor communities of color. So it's an important conversation. The police are, in many ways, the first responders and the face of the justice system in our communities. So it's something that we have to look at closely. But we also have to recognize that it's just part of a larger system that we're dealing with. And so in some ways, police are being called on to respond and deal with many issues that are far beyond their province. I mean, when we're talking about communities that are really struggling in terms of low unemployment rates, low incomes, high degree of substance abuse, and other issues, we need to make sure that we're investing in the right way, and that's not just through law enforcement.
since the prison system itself seems riddled with racism, with, you know, black men being much more likely to go to jail than white men, and just go to jail for far longer, how do you go about changing the racism that exists in the justice system if much of it is perhaps implicit rather than explicit, you know, due to unconscious biases rather than conscious bias?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think there's a couple of ways we can go about that, and we are seeing some success in this regard, particularly in some places in the juvenile justice systems around the country. And so one is to have an honest, data-driven conversation about these issues. It's not uncommon for stakeholders within the system, whether those be judges, prosecutors, defenders, probation officers, police, to be very defensive about the decisions that they make when they're being looked at from a racial perspective. And so we have to recognize that race is a very difficult thing to talk about in this country because of our history. And so it would behoove us to really think about this through the lens of objective data, how decisions are being made and what are the outcomes. So having that discussion, and again, that's happening in some systems around the country, is very important. I think, secondly, we have to recognize that this is an issue beyond the justice system. And as I noted earlier, look at how we are investing in communities, particularly in communities of color, where, quite frankly, we are spending much more on law enforcement and incarceration to the detriment of other issues that we should be dealing with, whether that's education, whether that's employment, whether that's health and housing issues. We have to really attack these on two tracks.
In terms of the push for reform of the criminal justice system, is this happening at the state level and is only now affecting our national politicians, or kind of what has been spearheading this movement that I assume our politicians are now catching up with?
Yeah, no, it's definitely a situation where the federal government is in many ways following the leadership of what's happened in states around the country. So as I mentioned earlier, budget issues really brought this to the fore in many states around the country. It wasn't the only issue, but it was definitely a driver where states were seeing that the amount they were spending on their prison system was just getting out of control. And that forced a number of state leaders to think about how they were spending their dollars and the outcomes they were getting. And so in a number of states, that resulted in a closer look at what they were doing in their justice systems and a reconsideration of some of the laws and policies that had been put into place in the 90s and the early 2000s. And that also started to take place across the aisle. So fiscal conservatives as well as progressives in state capitals around the country were starting to come together around these issues. And I think that created an opportunity for folks at the federal level to have a similar conversation.
This is Margot Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio. And if you're just tuning in, I'm here talking with Mark Schindler, Executive Director of the Justice Policy Institute. Mark, I know there have been a number of promising changes as regards juvenile justice. The U.S. incarcerates half the number of young people it used to 10 years ago. Tell us about how that change came about, and do you see what's happened there as a model that can be used for adult offenders?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's a little-known fact that in this country, we have significantly reduced the number of young people who are incarcerated around the country. As you said, it's gone from about 100,000 to about 50,000, so about half as many. There's still far too many young people incarcerated in this country, many of whom are locked up for nonviolent offenses, but we have made progress in that regard. And there are lessons we can learn. Some of what has happened is what I mentioned earlier, being much more data-driven in our looking at how we operate our juvenile justice system. So making sure that we are confining only those who are creating or pose a serious risk to public safety and investing much more wisely in alternatives to incarceration, whether that be day treatment centers or programs that really provide wraparound services for kids in the community. That's all led to a discussion and movement towards a more effective juvenile justice system in various states. And I would be remiss if I didn't talk about what's happened in Missouri specifically, because Missouri has been a leader, at least as it relates to the conditions in Missouri's facilities, which are amongst the best in the country, many would say, operating small, home-like facilities that are closer to kids' communities and really making an effort to connect them, their families, and have rehabilitative programming within their facilities. So Missouri has a right to be proud of the juvenile facilities it's running around the state.
Oh, well, that's good news to hear. You mentioned wraparound services, and I'm not sure that I understand what that phrase means. In fact, I know
I don't. Sure. Yeah, in some ways, when we think about the types of programs and services that we need and that should be implemented for young people and adults, it's really what we know works for essentially middle and upper class white kids in many communities who get the type of programming and services that they need outside of the justice system. So when I refer to wraparound, it's the type of services and opportunities that we wrap around many young people who are doing well, whether that's if they need it, mental health and substance abuse that usually comes through private insurance for kids who can afford it and their families. But that also includes educational support, whether that's tutoring, recreation opportunities, workforce experiences that kids in middle and upper class communities often get. Those are the types of things that all young people need. And I would say also young adults need who haven't progressed into the workforce. And so those are the types of things that we would do well to invest in. And if we did that, we would see far fewer people incarcerated.
Human rights organizations, international law experts, and many, probably most countries, consider solitary confinement a form of torture. Yet it seems solitary confinement is more widely used in American prisons today than it was 50 years ago. I understand that people estimate there may be as many as 80,000 prisoners experiencing solitary confinement in this country's prisons and jails. Even juveniles are often put in solitary confinement, despite the recognition that this has serious effects on people's mental health. What are the conditions inmates in solitary confinement face, and what's being done to challenge the use of that?
Yeah, you know, this in some ways has been the dirty little secret within the American correctional system, both in the criminal justice and juvenile justice system for many years, that's now, I think, finally being exposed and being referred to, I think, as it rightly should be, as in many ways torture. And so we see in prisons and jails and juvenile facilities across the country and over-reliance and drastic overuse of solitary confinement. Some of this resulted from crowding in facilities, and some of it has resulted from many people going into our facilities with severe mental health issues, and quite frankly, the correction system, both adult and juvenile, not being able to address their needs adequately, and so they put them in isolation or in solitary. These are very small cells with no natural light. Justice Kennedy of the Supreme Court has been speaking about this recently and essentially describing it, rightly so, as something that would drive anyone mad. And so it's something that we need to absolutely stop doing in this country, and I'm glad to see that people are talking about that now.
Well, is there any move in Congress to put an end to the use of solitary confinement, or is it something that seems to be being addressed by the courts more?
No, the good news is that there is discussion about this in Congress. Thus far, it's mostly as it relates to kids in the juvenile justice system. Senator Cory Booker, Congressman Cardenas in the House, both have introduced legislation that would significantly limit and restrict the use of solitary confinement for young people in the juvenile justice system. And that's a very encouraging step. We need to go further than that. So we need to pass that legislation, but we also need to expand that to apply to adults in the adult correctional system. There's also a number of states around the country on the juvenile justice side that have made progress in severely limiting or eliminating the use of solitary confinement for kids in the juvenile justice system. So that's all encouraging. We just need to make sure that that work continues and that that expands to adults in the adult correctional system.
I understand that the Senate Judiciary Committee on Thursday approved a bipartisan bill that would reduce federal mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. Do you think this bill will be passed by Congress this year? And are there any other legislative efforts going on that would be that we should know about?
Well, that's a very good question. I wish I could predict what Congress would do, but I can't do that. We are hopeful that the climate is right. Again, with crime rates being very low and with this bipartisan seeming consensus coming together, with the president speaking forcefully on this, with it being a topic of discussion in the presidential campaigns, that we will see something passed through Congress. So we are hopeful of that. The other, and in some ways related piece, is that the Federal Juvenile Justice Act, the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, is also pending in Congress, and that needs to be reauthorized. And so our hope is that will happen in this Congress as well.
Not so long ago, I did some research and discovered that there's been a move to make prison sentences longer and longer. Or when I say a move, that people are simply being sentenced to longer and longer prison sentences. What's led to that, and do you see that as something that will change given the kind of increasing enthusiasm for reforming our criminal justice system and incarcerating fewer people?
Well, you know, as we were talking earlier, and you're absolutely right about this, Margo, you know, as a result of the drug war, as a result of really the demonization of so many people around this country, particularly people of color and young people, we saw a drastic changes within the justice system in the 90s and the early 2000s, three strikes, you're out laws, mandatory minimums, federal incentives to lengthen sentences, truth in sentencing is what it's been referred to. And so that has really contributed to the mass incarceration that we see today. We are seeing some reflection on that and some changes that are improving that situation, but we need to go much further than what's happening now. And so we need to have an honest conversation, as we were talking about, regarding violent offenders in the system, not just nonviolent offenders. And we need to really apply the science about what we know works that will reduce the likelihood of people being involved with the justice system and increase the likelihood that they'll do well in their communities after they're incarcerated, if there is some term of incarceration.
I read a blog on the Huffington Post about a week ago. It was written by two experts at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law, Lauren Brooke Eisen and Inimai Chetiar. And I'm apologizing to Ms. Chetiar because I'm sure I'm mispronouncing her last name. And they say decades of bad policy helped create the era of mass incarceration. Our current incarceration epidemic was caused by financial incentives that promoted more arrests, prosecutions, and prison sentences. And today, they mention Washington sends $3.8 billion to the states each year to finance criminal justice, with dollars largely focused on increasing imprisonment. Do you think an end to federal aid to the states for criminal justice is going to be an important component in reducing mass incarceration?
Well, I wouldn't say an end to federal aid. What I would say, and I know that the Brennan Center and others are calling for, rightly so, is a shift in the way the federal funds go to the states. And when I say a shift, I mean the incentives that are created. So, as I had mentioned, and as the Brennan Center reports and others have showed, that over the years there were fiscal incentives at the federal level to increase the number of arrests, to increase the length of sentences, to build more prisons. And so those all had a tremendous impact on expanding the use of incarceration. The states still do need federal dollars, and it's an important and appropriate federal role to support work going on at the state level. But we need to switch those incentives. So we need federal dollars tied to not increasing arrests, but increasing public safety. We need federal dollars tied to not long sentences, but criminal justice policies that make sense and are based on the science. We need federal dollars not to incentivize building prisons, but rather to create effective alternatives in the community so that prison is a last and rare resort, and so that we can have safer communities because we're investing in them properly and supporting people with what they need. That will create safer communities in the long run, and it'll reduce our use of incarceration. And the federal government has a role to play in that.
Mr. Schindler, thank you so much for speaking with us. Our time is up, but we've appreciated having you on the program. And up next is the 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
I was just speaking with Houston's Police Chief Charles McClelland about the recent release from the UNODC calling for decriminalizing drugs. And here to fill us in on some details is the Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance, Mr. Ethan Nadelman. Hello, Ethan.
Hi, Dean. Good to be back on your program.
Oh, it's good to have you, sir. Now, that's a spark of bright light, isn't it, that release, even though it was rescinded, so to speak?
It is most definitely a step. I mean, what happened here was that the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, UNODC, which is traditionally seen as basically a defender and protagonist of the global drug war, put out a release on Friday basically calling for the decriminalization of drug use and possession and pointing out that this that decriminalization was not inconsistent with the International Drug Control Conventions, making clear that decriminalization of possession and use is a good policy from a public health and public safety and human rights perspective, and that it is not inconsistent with the conventions. Now, that said, they put out that document with an embargo. One of the journalists violated the embargo. It broke into the news. There were rumors that the U.S. government had contacted the United Nations Drug Control Office and asked them to rescind it. And so earlier this morning, Monday morning, the UN said that that document that is circulating, in fact, is not the official policy of the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. So the good news is that a document that looked like it was in final form was about to be released by the UN, really pointing in the right direction. The bad news is that they've since retracted that document, possibly under pressure from the U.S. government, but we're not certain of that.
Okay, and this follows on the heels of many other proponents of change, including Cory Booker and others who are trying to rescind the highway interdiction efforts and other means of mass incarceration. It is taking hold, is it not, this thought of this need for change?
It's interesting, Dean. What you see is if you look at three major areas of drug policy reform, one of them is ending marijuana prohibition. And that's an area where the U.S. has been at the forefront, and a few countries like Uruguay have also moved forward. So in that, and I think that the U.S. is providing real global leadership at this point in terms of trying to move cannabis from a prohibition system into a regulatory system.
Be sure to tune in to tomorrow's report. We'll have part two of our discussion with Ethan Nadelman, the Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m. followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Liam, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musicale.